Hello and welcome to Inside Politics. I'm John King in Washington. Thank you for sharing your day with us. The docket and Donald Trump. Today, a witness tries to undermine Michael Cohen's credibility and help Donald Trump avoid indictment in a hush money plot. The former president, though, predicts his arrest, and already House Republicans now wargaming to attack the prosecutor. Plus, China's Xi Jinping touches down in Moscow for his face-to-face meeting with Vladimir Putin. Xi says China and Russia share key goals. Unclear, though, is whether Putin gets the help he wants from China in his war on Ukraine. And $3 billion, a Swiss bank spends big to take over its struggling rival. Financial markets are reacting positively, but what does this mean for your money? Up first for us, though, the week that could bring history. Criminal charges against Donald Trump. The former president predicts as much, saying he expects to be arrested tomorrow. New developments today underscore the tension and the high stakes. At issue, the 2016 hush money payment paid to the adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Longtime Trump fixer Michael Cohen made that payment. Cohen says Trump reimbursed him and falsified business records in the process. Today, a potential final witness. Robert Costello is a Trump-connected attorney who once represented Michael Cohen. Costello asked to speak to the Manhattan grand jury. He says he has emails and other records that undermine Cohen's credibility. Cohen says he's on standby as a rebuttal witness, camped out right now with Manhattan prosecutors. The Manhattan DA says he communicated nothing to Trump or his lawyers about his decisions or his timing. But the former president over the weekend foreshadowed a Tuesday arrest and in one of his postings urged his supporters to protest. Let's get straight to CNN's Kara Scannell, live for us in New York. Kara, a lot of dust flying here. What do we actually know?
Well, John, we are expecting Bob Costello, that Trump-connected attorney, to appear next hour or so and go before the grand jury. Now, sources tell us that he reached out to the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and Trump lawyers saying he had information that would contradict Michael Cohen's previous statements. Cohen, of course, pleaded guilty to federal charges several years ago. And at the time, he said that he made the payments in coordination with and at the direction of former President Trump. Now, Costello has already turned over hundreds of documents and emails to prosecutors to support his position. And Trump's lawyers asked them to call him before the grand jury. They said Costello would be saying that Trump, that Cohen said that Trump did not do anything illegal in connection with these payments. So the DA's office conducting this long investigation, looking right now, we're kind of in the end game at whether the former president, whether to charge the former president with a number of potential crimes. Those could include falsifying business records for how those invoices were that Cohen sent and how the payments were reimbursed to Michael Cohen. That would be a misdemeanor. They could also try to make a felony case here that is charging the falsification of business records to commit or conceal another crime. There's also the possibility they have some other legal theory up their sleeve. But we're, you know, kind of reaching the end game of this because we've seen a number of the major witnesses, the people that had inside knowledge about these hush money payments, already come in and meet with prosecutors and go before the grand jury. So we expect a decision in this case to be made in the near term. Now, of course, Trump going public over the weekend, making this claim that he thought he was going to be arrested. Bragg's office saying in an email to their employees that they will not be intimidated. John?
And Kara, even before the former president's weekend post saying he wants his supporters to protest, there have been conversations among law enforcement, among city officials and among federal officials here in D.C. about the possibility of stepping up security. What do we know about that?
What seems to be going on inside the grand jury?
You were already seeing signs of that this morning. Our team spotted the NYPD putting cameras on top of some of the lights all in the vicinity of the courthouse here. They've also just put out a bunch of barricades, kind of showing that they are expecting there to be potentially some kind of event or protest, as the former president has called for some of his followers to come and protest. It's also the potential security risks are being discussed in NYPD and federal and state and city briefings among law enforcement personnel. And there are also, sources tell us, monitoring social media posts for any potential unrest. John?
Kara Scannell on the ground for us in New York. Important reporting. Kara, thank you. We know you'll stay on top of this as the day and the rest of the week plays out. Let's bring the conversation in the room with me to share their reporting and their insights. CNN's Evan Perez, CNN's Sarah Murray, and former federal prosecutor Elliot Williams. Let's start with what we do know. And I just want to start with you, Counselor, on the history here. No sitting or former president in American history has been charged criminally. So if this happens, Donald Trump says it might happen tomorrow. We don't know if that's just pure speculation or whether his lawyers believe that to be the case. What is the burden on the prosecutor, knowing you have the details of the case, but you have a a rendezvous with history.
Look, there's two answers to that, John. The burden on the prosecutor is the same as it would be in any other case, which is that if you have probable cause to bring charges and you can get them past a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, then you get a conviction. That's the simple, easy, obvious answer. But like you said, it's a rendezvous with history. This is a profound moment. And we live in the real world. It's the charging of a president with a crime. And to sort of quote The Wire, the TV show, you come at the king, you best not miss. You have to, if charging a former president of the United States, know or feel confident that you can proceed with something that's going to win. This is not just an ordinary criminal case under any circumstance.
And that's why there's been such a great debate. Is this the case? If you're going to have a rendezvous with history, is this at least the case that should go first? Facts of the case. We know the president had some kind of, whether it's a friendship or an affair, with Stormy Daniels, the adult film actress. She received a $130,000 payment in October 2016, right before the election. Michael Cohen made that payment. He wrote the check used to allegedly buy her silence. That was the idea. And then the investigation is the Trump Organization reimburses Michael Cohen. Do they falsify business records to cover up what this was? And so, as Kara laid out, could be a misdemeanor, could be a felony. Where are we?
Right. I mean, and the idea that you would bring a misdemeanor against a former president, right, that doesn't seem to make any sense. So everyone, and again, there's a lack of information from the district attorney, but everything indicates that they're going to go bigger on this. And so the question is, the former president is facing multiple investigations, including this one, the one in Georgia related to the election, and the one in the Justice Department, which has two investigations going against the former president. The other thing that I think we can't forget is that, some of the stuff related to Stormy Daniels was looked at by federal prosecutors in New York some time ago, and they decided not to bring those charges. So we'll have to see what the district attorney has turned up in their investigation that's different, and obviously different under New York law, that makes them believe they should bring this case.
And one of the issue is the quality of the witnesses.
Yeah.
You're trying to make this allegation. You have Michael Cohen, who is an admitted liar, but was prosecuted for lies. He says now he's telling the truth. He says he was paid to lie for Donald Trump, and that's what he did, and now he's telling the truth. Mr. Costello reaches out over the weekend. Robert Costello tells CNN he's handed over hundreds of documents to the Manhattan District Attorney, including more than 300 emails related to Trump's former fixer and lawyer, Michael Cohen. So you have he once represented Michael Cohen, but he's in the Trump orbit. I mean, who are you to believe in this cast of known liars?
Well, right. I mean, you're already in a somewhat unusual situation by having, a witness go in that is, providing essentially a defense for the former president and then having Michael Cohen on standby to rebut that. That doesn't happen all the time. Again, there have been issues with Michael Cohen's credibility. There have always been issues. That came up when federal prosecutors looked at this. The other thing we do have to remember, though, is grand juries deal with witnesses that have these kind of issues all the time. When you are dealing with regular murder cases, when you are dealing with regular drug cases, you're not dealing with the most pristine of figures who are making these cases, who are appearing as witnesses before the grand jury. But this is a case involving the former president. And it again brings you to the question of, is this really the case you want to pursue? Is this really the witness you want to hang your hat on?
And yet, to your point, if they believe they have the evidence, yep, it's their duty to bring it, whether he's Donald Trump or John Doe. The question is, New York state law allows you, if you think you're getting close to the finish line, you reach out to Trump and you say you want to testify before the grand jury. He declined that. But Mr. Costello is essentially coming in on the Trump legal team's behalf here. At the end of this investigation, today, Costello, over the weekend, Trump says he'll be arrested. Last week, Michael Cohen was back before the grand jury. He's actually with prosecutors today in case they think they need him to go in to answer Costello. Trump was invited to testify and said no. You had Kellyanne Conway and Hope Hicks. So you do have new witnesses being brought in who were around Trump at the time of all this. So there's no question they're at the end.
Yeah.
But how do you make that decision?
Well, how do you make the decision? Look, it's in the prosecutor's interest to have Costello come in, because if a matter were to go to trial, you would have heard from Costello anyway. And you don't want the first time you hear from a witness to be when you put him on the witness stand for the first time. So, look, it's pretty clear that prosecutors have sussed out what their case is, but also trying to figure out what the holes might be in the case. And it's some of these credibility issues with Michael Cohen. Bless you for making that point, because it's a very important one. You can still get convictions in drug and homicide cases where you have ugly and dirty witnesses, but you just got to know what you're going into court with, and I think that's what they're doing.
Prosecutors, I'm sure, are going to show the video of Trump being asked on the plane during the campaign, early on, which he said, he'd never heard of this payment. He didn't know anything about it. And obviously now they've made their new excuse is that, or their new response to this is that, we paid it, but it was all Michael Cohen. So Right. You know, that's the thing that I think will come back if and when this goes to trial.
And as we wait for the decision in New York and we see the security, we are reminded there are federal investigations of Donald Trump. There's also the special Fulton County grand jury in Georgia. You have some new reporting there that the Trump's lawyers have essentially gone into court to essentially try to throw the whole thing out.
Yeah.
Say, we know you're near the finish line there as well. We don't think you have anything. Throw it out.
Very interesting timing that all of this is. This is the first time the Trump attorneys in Georgia have decided that they are going to weigh in legally on this case. And essentially, they're saying, look, we want the last sort of 8 months to not have happened. Toss the report from the special grand jury, toss all the evidence collected by the special grand jury, which is really meaningful. And by the way, also disqualify the district attorney's office from even investigating this. They take issues with the judge's ruling in this case, with the way the district attorney has comported himself, with, of course, the four persons media tour that she went on. So this is quite an aim to disqualify a whole lot related to this case. They're asking for a judge, not the one who oversaw the grand jury, basically anyone else on the bench, to listen to this. And, you know, we'll see how it sits with the judges.
Make any sense?
You know, it really does. It's hard to get a case thrown out because the law presumes that people and jurors can actually set aside some of the silliness. But look, you know, to be clear, that grand juror did, special grand juror, did no favors to prosecutors by being out there talking. The prosecutor herself was pretty clear on the record that she intended to indict the president even when she was running for office. So, you know, look, they have an argument. They're not going to win on it, and it's not going to get tossed out.
But it's another reminder that, you know, Trump has done this for years. He plays very aggressive when any suits, whether it's about his business, whether about his presidency, whether it's about this. He is very aggressive with his lawyers. We will watch and see what happens. Up next for us, though, President Xi and Putin holding a big summit in Moscow. Just the meeting is a boost for Putin. But what he wants most is help on the battlefield in Ukraine. Right now, incredibly high-stakes meetings playing out in Moscow. China's Xi Jinping telling the Russian President Vladimir Putin at the beginning of those talks that the two leaders, quote, share similar goals. They are meeting face-to-face.
It is true that both of our countries share the same or similar goals.
This is Xi's first visit to Russia since Putin's invasion of Ukraine began a little more than a year ago. The war, top of mind, as Putin aims to secure lethal aid for the fight. China, though, maintaining it is neutral in the conflict. That is its position publicly. And President Xi's team says this is a visit, quote, a trip for peace. It's being watched around the world, this meeting. Let's bring in CNN's Will Ripley. He's joining us now live from Taiwan. Will, the Chinese say this is all about peace, but around the world, people are quite skeptical.
Oh, absolutely. When you have Chinese warplanes flying near this self-governing democracy that Beijing's communist rulers have been coveting for more than 70 years, even though they've never controlled it. In fact, there's a tweet out from the president's spokesperson, Kola Shiotaka, that kind of sums up the view, I would say, of the Taiwanese government. It reads, China keeps sending warplanes and ships to harass Taiwan every day. Unless China stops its dangerous provocations, how can Xi Jinping's visit to Russia offer any chance for peace? This is where this whole neutrality narrative really comes into question, because what Xi is expressing willingness to work with Putin to do is to, in their words, safeguard the international order. But the international order, in the eyes of Putin and Xi, involves destabilizing the peace that the United States has enforced globally since the end of World War II. They want to disrupt the influence of the United States and the West. They share that ideology. And that is more important to Xi Jinping, apparently, than alienating the United States and Europe, even though there are vast political and economic consequences as a result. And that's why probably, John, you see Xi Jinping, putting on this diplomat hat, going to the Middle East, for example, to broker, the latest attempt at a peace deal between Saudi Arabia and obviously this is something that John, I just lost my train of thought. It's about very late late at night here, but as you can see, this is certainly a very significant moment, and we'll have to see how it all plays out.
And we'll watch what actions come beyond the words. Will Ripley live for us in Taipei. Will, thank you. Let's get some important perspective now from the former director of national intelligence and our CNN national security analyst, James Clapper. Director Clapper, grateful for your time today. The picture is just the picture is important. This is Xi and Putin essentially saying to the United States and to the West, it's us versus you, essentially. But beyond the picture and beyond President Xi saying we have shared goals, what are you most looking for out of this meeting?
Well, I don't. What I'm most looking for, of course, is what kind of announcement they make, which I think will be a good bit of form and of solidarity, evincing solidarity. And I think there'll be emphasis on trade and economic relations. Interestingly, Russia now is past Saudi Arabia in exporting oil to China. And I think that sort of thing. I don't look for China to provide major weapon systems, for example, to Putin. I think Putin probably has high expectations, which I don't think are going to be fulfilled.
Why is that? In the context of, you know, Xi is the big power at this meeting. If we were having this conversation 10 or 20 years ago, you might view Russia as the bigger power or at least them as equals. There's no question Xi is the tail wagging the dog at the moment. Forgive the expression. Why do you think Xi does not want to get involved from a lethal aid or at least a significant visible lethal aid perspective?
I think what's really important to Xi at this point is coming on the heels of this Mideast agreement in which he brokered an arrangement whereby Saudi and Iran recognize each other diplomatically. I think he wants to be seen as a statesman above all. I could be wrong about that, but I think that's what uppermost and important. I also don't think, and I've said this since the outset of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that he wants the look, the image of Chinese weapon systems being used to kill innocent Ukrainians and bomb Ukrainian infrastructure. So I think from an image standpoint, which he's trying to burnish on the heels of his unprecedented election to a third term as an international statesman and international leader. And I think that's uppermost in his mind.
Putin needs the help because he's had a tough year on the battlefield, especially if you're looking at big picture. You can look at individual battles and maybe say the Russians won that one. But big picture, Russia is on its heels and actually in many ways, you might say, humiliated. Putin needs the help because the United States, NATO and others have held together in supporting Ukraine. What's the flip side of that from Xi's perspective? Has the solid, resilient Western alliance perhaps changed his thinking? Knowing that he's publicly on the record saying, I will take Taiwan at some point.
Well, I think it's the whole experience that Russia's had in Ukraine has, I believe, given pause to the Chinese about an invasion of Taiwan. You know, the Chinese haven't fought in an active combat since 1979 against the Vietnamese, and they didn't do so well. So I think Xi's got to think twice about assessing the will to fight of his own forces and the will to resist on the part of the Taiwanese. So, again, I think he's going to be he's got a balancing act, clearly, but I think he's going to be very careful about extending himself too much to the Russians.
Director Clapper, appreciate your insights at this delicate moment. We will watch what the leaders say. And, of course, then more importantly, we'll watch what they do in the days and weeks ahead. Appreciate your time, sir, very much.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. Up next, you see a look right there at the Dow. Financial markets weighing new developments positively so far in the banking crisis. The Swiss government stepping in to orchestrate a major bank takeover. That to open a week in which the Federal Reserve also faces a big decision about interest rates. This is a big week for economic news, and it's off to a positive beginning if markets are your barometer. U.S. markets are up mostly today. You see right there the Nasdaq down just a little bit. That after a shotgun wedding between two big Swiss banks, UBS, Switzerland's biggest bank, agreeing to buy its former rival, Credit Suisse, for cents on the dollar. That as regulators scramble to stem a global banking crisis. The Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, Federal Reserve Chief Jerome Powell, both applauding that move orchestrated and announced by Swiss authorities over the weekend. Let's check in with CNN's Matt Egan in New York, live with the latest. Matt, this merger, if you will, this takeover, designed to calm things down. How's that going?
Well, John, so far so good. I think Wall Street is breathing a sigh of relief after another tense weekend in Washington and really across capitals in Europe. UBS coming to the rescue of Credit Suisse. You know, this bank, Credit Suisse, it's been a problem for years, long before the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. And really, it was facing a crisis of confidence. Share price was imploding. Billions of dollars were coming out of Credit Suisse. It was unsustainable. And so that's why regulators pushed UBS to come to the rescue and bail this bank out. Now, the hope is that this will restore some confidence in the banking system and shore up one of the weakest links. Now, we also have to take a look at what's going on in the U.S. regional bank sector because that has really been moving the wider market. And regional banks are moving mostly higher. Well, they were moving mostly higher. We see that some of the banks have turned negative. First Republic has been in the red most of the day, but it's actually near session lows right now, down 41%. Now, this comes after First Republic was downgraded over the weekend further into junk territory by both S&P and Moody's. That's despite the industry-led rescue that First Republic got just last week. We did get some encouraging signs, though, on the regional bank front, because more important than the share price is what's happening with the deposits. Now, we don't have a great view into deposits, but regulators do, and they're watching very closely. And a U.S. official telling CNN's Phil Mattingly and I that deposits at the small and mid-sized regional banks, that they have stabilized, that those massive deposit outflows, they've either eased or stopped or even reversed altogether. And that is really important. I think at the end of the day, why this really matters to real people is less about whether or not your money is safe in the bank. We know the FDIC insures up to $250,000. It's really about what this does to the economy. Because the longer the bank crisis lasts, the more expensive it's going to be to borrow, right? Mortgages, car loans, credit cards, small business loans, all of them are going to be harder to get and more expensive. And John, the concern is that the longer that lasts, the greater the risk that this ends up causing the recession that everyone's been so worried about.
Which is why we'll watch throughout the week, A, the banking stocks, B, the Fed's decision, and more. Matt Egan, appreciate your kicking us off. Let's get some more insights now from Bloomberg's Peggy Collins. So it's an extraordinary step. The Swiss government steps in, essentially sells UBS, let me help you take over our Credit Suisse. Done like that, they think they've put out a fire. The question is, did they put it out the right way? The Wall Street Journal editorial board saying, in the biggest insult to the market, regulators will allow this deal to proceed without a vote of either bank's shareholders. These are publicly traded companies, but the government came in and said, bam, you're married now. Is there long-term ramifications of that, or is it use of power? Is it the necessary use of power in this case?
Well, I think there will be precedents that are set. They did change some of the rules. You know, they in some ways put shareholders, equity stock shareholders, ahead of bondholders, which is not the traditional way that these situations go. But I think it was clear that they felt like they could not let a global bank like Credit Suisse go down. It's connected to so many other markets, including in the U.S., and that's why we also saw Treasury and Fed officials come out very quickly last night and say that they welcome the deal as well as a lot of other central banks around the world.
And so your team at Bloomberg has done this. A lot of others are looking at it. Gina Smilak, who's a frequent guest on the program of the New York Times, over the weekend tweeting out, the Fed saw the big risk at SVB more than a year before its collapse. It put it under supervisory review. It put it under review risk management. It banned it from growing through acquisition. It didn't work. Now the question is why? It's a big question. As you're still in the middle of this developing crisis, or call it what you will, and Elizabeth Warren says Jerome Powell's to blame.
He's failing in both jobs, both as the oversight manager of these big banks, which is his job, and also what he's doing with inflation. I don't think he should be chairman of the Federal Reserve.
The senator blames the chairman. To the question, it didn't work, why? Do we know the answer?
I think that's still unfolding, John. As you said, we've been reporting and others around what happened with the regulators out in San Francisco in particular. Also, were there some changes that went down in 2018 that deregulated things almost too much and led to less regulation around small and mid-sized banks that could have led to this? And then the question of FDIC insurance, where do we go from here? So I think we're only at the beginning of potential policy changes here.
And one other big policy decision comes midweek, which is the Fed's interest rate decision. Again, if you're looking at the inflation fight, you would expect them to raise rates again. if you're looking at trying to, say, calm things down, you might say they'll take a timeout. Do we know the answer there?
We don't yet, but Powell's in a tough spot, not only in terms of questions about regulation, but also in terms of what he does from here. So our reporting is showing that the market is basically either pricing in likely a pause in terms of interest rate rises or potentially a quarter point basis point hike. But they are in a tough spot, right? We're in a banking crisis right now. As you've seen, they've done a lot of action. You could pause and say, hey, we need to make sure nothing else breaks in the economy. But if you do pause, does that potentially indicate to people that there's something else underneath that you see that we don't yet?
Oof, uncertainty as we begin the week. We'll call on you throughout it as we try to answer some of these questions. Peggy Collins, thank you. Up next for us, Donald Trump trying right now to turn legal woe into political gain. Donald Trump is aggressively might be an understatement, pushing to turn a legal showdown with the Manhattan District Attorney into a boost for his 2024 presidential campaign. Former president says he expects to be arrested tomorrow. And fundraising emails were churning out over the weekend, like this one, urging supporters to, quote, defend the greatest political movement in history. Trump's son, Don Jr., making clear that Trump allies are keeping score as they demand Republicans publicly stand with Trump. Look at this tweet from Donald Trump Jr. Pay attention to which Republicans spoke out against this corrupt BS immediately and who sat on their hands and waited to see which way the wind was blowing. With me in studio to share their reporting and their insights, Sungmin Kim of the Associated Press, Nicholas Wu of Politico, and Tia Mitchell of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So, pretty clear, President Trump believes he can benefit from this, at least in the immediate. Gin up support, grievance, they're out to get me. Don Jr. says, watch everybody as they step forward. Well, this morning, the governor of Florida, a potential 2024 rival, did speak out. Listen.
I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that. Ordinary Americans in all these different jurisdictions, that they get victimized every day because of the reckless political agenda that these Soros DAs bring to their job.
The last part was echoing Trump's argument. George Soros gave financial contributions. But the first part, that's a DeSantis dig at Trump, is it not? At his character, suggesting to voters, remember porn star, hush money?
I mean, that is the classic. You can take a dig while try to say what you need to say to appeal to the broader base. And I was just, it's kind of pretty deft if you have to respond, because you saw the pressure actually build from Trump allies starting yesterday for DeSantis specifically to respond, because you saw a bunch of leadership on Capitol Hill, as well as other 24 candidates, talk about this, what the DA may or may not do. But Trump allies are really singling out DeSantis, and that's how DeSantis responded. So in kind of one a little long sentence, you can you not only distinguish yourself, but also align yourself with the base that wants support for Trump, even if they may not be voting for Trump themselves.
Right. And it does put the other 2024 prospects, whether they're declared or undeclared, in an odd spot, in the sense that all those prospects hope that character questions or winning questions, can he win, can he be competitive questions about Donald Trump, help hurt him and help them. And yet, like Mike Pence, who is critical of Donald Trump on January 6th, in this case says, don't do it, Mr. Prosecutor.
Just feel like it's just not what the American people want to see. The American people are anxious about the future, and here we go again, back into another politically charged prosecution directed at the former president of the United States.
This would be the first prosecution of Donald Trump. He's referring to congressional investigations and the like and the impeachments. I guess you could call that a prosecution, but this would be history. No American president, sitting or former, has been charged criminally.
It really is. We're going into uncharted territory here. And in many ways, it provides an opportunity for other Republican candidates to distinguish themselves from Trump. As Sungmin was saying, we saw DeSantis kind of tacitly make that comparison there in a way that we haven't seen from the rest of the field. Nikki Haley, for example, has been making the case for herself affirmatively, but not in a way that really draws a bright line with Trump that might be necessary to come out in a primary.
We have seen Donald Trump use this to his advantage in the past. The grievances, they're out to get me, it's a witch hunt. In this case, they say, because the DA, Alvin Bragg, took contributions from George Soros. This is all about the globalists and George Soros. If you're somebody who's not a fan of Trump, like the governor of New Hampshire, and you're trying to find a lane, at this moment in time, you're thinking, damn it, this helps him.
There's a lot of unknowns. I can tell you, I think it's building a lot of sympathy for the former president. I think the fact that I was with coffee this morning with some folks, and there's none of them were big Trump supporters, but they all said, they felt like he was being attacked. This has nothing to do with January 6th. There's folks out there that still think this has something to do with January 6th.
The question is, can he sustain it? There's no question. Again, whatever your views of Donald Trump at home, he is very good at this, at the turning on the grievance machine. They're out to get me. Rally the troops around you. So even if you have doubts about Trump over this, that, or the other thing, it's like you have to stand with Trump right now. If you're trying to find a path, an anti-Trump path, you see Sununu, people have sympathy.
Right. And the question is, can he sustain it? The other question is what is his ceiling? Because, yes, there are Republican voters that are standing with Trump no matter what, and they're ready to rally behind him. And we know that could be a plurality, for example, needed to win a primary. But is that enough to sustain him in a general election? Is that enough to really sustain him with the wider electorate is a big question. And I think that's one that we see the Republicans not thinking about as much because they're thinking in the parameters of a primary.
And one test of that, number one, in one of his posts, he said, if it happens, if he gets charged, and that's still an if, right. His supporters should protest. The other one is with their fundraising emails. I counted five or six just this over the weekend. How much money does he raise? Is there success? A lot of that money ends up going to legal fees, I think. But we'll see. We'll continue the conversation next. The Trump effect on House Republicans. A retreat designed as a policy conference instead overshadowed now as Trump allies vow to investigate the Manhattan prosecutor who is investigating Trump. House Republicans are at what is supposed to be a policy retreat right now in Florida, but yet again under a Trump cloud. The event was meant to focus on delivering on their policy promises. Now, though, more and more Republicans at that meeting responding to the former president's claims that he believes he's about to be indicted. This morning, Jim Jordan, who is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, going on conservative TV to say he's asking the Manhattan District Attorney to testify behind closed doors to his committee. That after Kevin McCarthy, the House Speaker, vowed Republicans would go on offense for Trump. Our great reporters are back at the table. And so let's listen to Jim Jordan. Again, Donald Trump says he expects to be indicted and arrested this week. We don't know if that's going to happen. We're waiting. But already Jim Jordan says to the Manhattan District Attorney, I want to talk to you behind closed doors for an interview.
President Trump announced he was going to run for president again. And suddenly here they go. Now they're coming after him for some alleged bookkeeping error. You've got to be kidding me. So we want to know what kind of federal involvement may have taken place.
It's the last part. Jordan's a master at this. This is a New York, Manhattan local prosecutor. We want to know what kind of federal involvement may have taken place. Is there any evidence of federal involvement here?
Well, that was my initial question when I saw the letter, because obviously Congress generally has jurisdiction over federal issues, federal matters. But this Manhattan DA is a state official. It's a local official. So it's, you know, Jordan's kind of putting out this wink, wink, nudge, nudge thing out in the ether. But broadly speaking, it's really remarkable how House Republicans are really using the levers of government that they have to, you know, defend Trump as the president may or may not face this indictment this week. And I think that perhaps Speaker McCarthy feels he has no other choice. We saw how reliant he is on that Trump flank to keep his speakership. But it really is a new level what is going on here.
And that's what makes it so interesting. If you're Jim Jordan, you got a very reliably Republican district. So this is safe for you, right? Standing up for Donald Trump is actually good for you back home. Kevin McCarthy, as you note, is dependent on that right flank that made him speaker, including Marjorie Taylor Greene. We'll get to her in a minute. But interestingly, Kevin McCarthy says, we want to investigate the investigator. We will use our power to look into what's happening here. But he did make one distinction from Trump. Trump, in one of his posts over the weekend, said he wanted his supporters to protest. Kevin McCarthy says, please don't.
I don't think people should protest this, no. And I think President Trump, if you talk to him, he doesn't believe that either. We want calmness out there. Nobody put violence or harm to anything else.
That is a key distinction born of memories of January 6th, no matter how much House Republicans want to whitewash it, and the idea that if it gets violent or protests, that might hurt the party.
Yes, I mean, that That exactly is born out of the memory of January 6th. We saw what happened there as Trump helped fan the flames, and many of his allies did. And here we have Republicans saying, you know, pump the brakes a little bit. We have, you know, 18 or so House Republicans who are in districts won by Biden, right, where that kind of rhetoric, that kind of fiery rhetoric doesn't necessarily play as well with voters there. And so, you know, this is the kind of tricky line Republicans are going to have to walk on this.
And Marjorie Taylor Greene, again, key to Kevin McCarthy's speakership, she was asked over the weekend, you know, people were saying, you know, Trump didn't say peaceful protest. He said protest. And she said, of course he meant that. Americans have the right to assemble and the right to protest. Trump doesn't have to say peaceful for him to mean peaceful. Of course he means peaceful. She's not opposed to protests.
No, she's not. And I mean, for Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's one of the staunchest Trump allies in the House. And she's defending him and defending the right to protest and defending his calls to protest. I just find it so interesting that House members, that wink Sungmin was talking about, because it's that wink of, you know, looking into the weaponization of the federal government, but in the process, weaponizing the federal government to defend former President Trump. People like Marjorie Taylor Greene are all for that, but also all for Trump's calls for whatever happens in the streets, of course, but giving themselves plausible deniability should anything become violent.
Now, if the House Republicans proceed with this, they sent the letters to Alvin Bragg. We'll see how the case plays out. We'll see how the Congress plays out. Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, says Democrats will participate and push back as aggressively as possible. But listen here, this is Mark Kelly, Democratic senator from Arizona, just reelected. So he's got a 6-year term, not a lot to worry about in the short term. He says this is dangerous for the Manhattan prosecutor.
I would hope that if they brought charges, that they have a strong case, because this is, as you said, it's unprecedented. And, you know, there's certainly, you know, risks involved here. But again, nobody in our nation is or should be above the law.
Very careful there. Nobody's above the law. Very clear about that. But a guy, a Democrat from a purple state, again, even though he's got 6 years before he has to go back before the voters, essentially saying, please be careful here.
Right. And it'd be interesting to, for him to elaborate on what risks mean. Like, there certainly could be political risks for Democrats here. Perhaps not, because, again, this is unprecedented. It is the indictment of a former president. You know, it comes at a time when Republicans were already turning from the party. But obviously, you know, just physical risks as well. And hopefully, you know, things remain calm and that remains the case.
Right. And the key to that is we wait. We wait the news. Again, Donald Trump saying he expects to be indicted and arrested tomorrow. We do not know that. We will watch the investigation play out in Manhattan. Up next for us, freedom. An American held hostage for, get this, 6 years in Africa. Soon be heading back home. Topping our political radar today, an American citizen held hostage for 6 years in West Africa has been freed. Jeffrey Woodke was kidnapped and held in Niger while working there as an American aid worker. Humanity is on thin ice, and that ice melting fast. That warning, courtesy of the United Nations Secretary General, made in tandem with a brand new United Nations report labeling the planet a ticking time bomb. The document says every nation needs to bump up their net zero climate goals by a decade to avert irreversible climate consequences. And a special visit to the White House today, Jason Sudeikis and the cast of Ted Lasso will meet with President Biden and the First Lady to discuss the importance of mental health. Thanks for your time today on Inside Politics. We'll see you tomorrow. Brianna Keeler picks up our coverage right now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.